Good day and welcome to Ascend Radio, your home for news, insight, and analysis on regulation and digital government. I'm your host, Paul Levoy, and today we're going to be talking to one of regulation's international heavyweights, Harry Katen himself. As one of the world's leading regulatory authorities, Harry is an advisor on professional regulation and governance, and he's widely sought after for his experience with regulatory practices. I'll include a more well-rounded overview of his qualifications in the show description, but here's a high-level rundown. In addition to serving as chief executive of the UK's Professional Standards Authority, which he helped create, Harry pioneered right-touch regulation. That's a regulatory decision-making approach that's been adopted by regulatory bodies all around the world. Quite notably, in 2018, he completed one of many statutory inquiries, this one into the College of Dental Surgeons of British Columbia. And his recommendations there have brought about sweeping changes in the province and helped the provincial government initiate large-scale regulation reform in general. Harry has received many awards, including the OBE for services to people with dementia, the CBE for services to health and regulation reform, and an outstanding leadership award from the World Health Executive Forum. In today's podcast, Harry and I discuss a whole variety of topics from fairness, equality, diversity in regulation, the regulatory challenges of the pandemic, and moral duty in the context of regulation. Just one note for listeners, Harry and I did record this session a few months ago before the emergence of the Omicron variant. That's just something to keep in mind in light of the ever-changing global pandemic we're all experiencing, but the insights he shares are no less true. So without further ado, let's listen to our conversation. Welcome, Harry, and thank you for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Paul.
Harry, today we're going to be talking about a variety of things, but one thing that I know is dear to you and close to your heart is a not often talked about area in the field of regulation and professional licensing, and that's the role of regulators with regards to equality and diversity across professions. What's been your exposure to sort of the intersection of equality and diversity in the field of professional licensing to date?
Well, I think it's a really interesting question to raise. One of the central tenets, of course, of regulatory action is fairness. And so fairness must take regard for equality and diversity. And this is often, and rightly on one level, seen as ensuring that professionals who are appropriately qualified have the same rights of entry to a profession, regardless of their background, their ethnicity, or their colour. Or gender even, we have to say still, unfortunately. And this, of course, is a big challenge as we move into a global economy where professionals move around between countries and yet where regulation is still primarily local in the United States, in Canada, of course, it's provincial and state governments that are responsible. Australia, they have now moved away from control being at state level and territory level and have a national framework. But in some countries in Europe, regulation is still at a very, very local level. So we have this issue of the recognition of qualifications across jurisdictions, and we have an issue of potential discrimination and racism as people move with qualifications that were valid in their own countries into new countries where regulation has its own standards and rules.
There's a lot to unpack there. So I think in...
Yes, and I'm sorry to go on at length, but of course the first thing is that regulators have a duty to be fair to registrants, and they also have a duty to be fair and open to their registrants, service users, clients, patients, whatever.
What sort of protections have existed historically to recognize diversity?
Well, you know, if we're really being historical, the answer is none. Because, of course, what a regulator does is discriminate. It discriminates between those who are qualified and those who are not qualified, as it defines qualification. So we might argue that the whole basis of regulation is discriminatory. It is about defining a group of people who are entitled under the law in that jurisdiction to do a particular task. So the issue there, of course, is that culturally and historically, I would say, regulators have been exclusionary. Their job has been to keep out people who do not fit into their definition of appropriate to carry out that task. And that makes discrimination on inappropriate grounds, so race, colour, gender, qualifications and so on, much easier for regulators to do. So there's quite a big cultural shift for a regulator to recognise that actually they need to be enablers of people to do jobs rather than protectors of the people who already do them.
What have been some of the impacts of that, the lack of recognition of the importance of diversity and the pervasive discriminatory tendencies, understandably discriminatory, as you said, it's the basis of the existence of professional licensing and regulation. But what have been some of the impacts that you've seen of that?
Well, I think we have seen professionals, particularly immigrants into countries, feeling that the barriers put up to stop them from practicing the profession they perhaps practiced in their previous country are very difficult. And Canada actually has led the way in a sense with, in some provinces, with fairness commissioners whose job it is actually to enable people who have appropriate qualifications from other countries to work in Canada. United States has always also been welcoming in many ways to immigrants, although perhaps politically less so in the most recent period. And the UK in that sense has followed the United States, having been very open and welcoming, and now since the referendum we had on the European Union, closing its borders to a large number of people. So, but I do think, I mean, I don't want to be too negative about this. I think many regulators and many jurisdictions have done a huge amount in recent years to both understand the internal discrimination that people from minority communities experience and to address both their registration procedures and their discipline procedures in order to make them fair and open. But I would say that there is a bit of a mismatch between legislative requirements and moral duty in this area. And I think that the Black Lives Matter campaigns have highlighted to a great extent the way in which professions are still rather limited in their openness to the full range of humanity, if I can put it that way.
When you say that there have been some developments or improvements, can you cite any examples that you've seen either in the UK or internationally?
Yeah, well, you know, let's start in Australia. So there have been, and New Zealand, there have been very, very strong movements towards cultural recognition of First Nations, understanding of the discrimination experienced by First Nations and Indigenous peoples in terms of access to services, and real efforts by regulators to address that. In New Zealand, the Medical Council, for instance, actually has standards written into its standards for doctors to ensure or to persuade that they should be open to Maori health issues in a particular way. In the UK, the British Medical Council, the General Medical Council, which has been criticised, I have to say, but has nevertheless done a huge amount of internal research to ensure that its discipline, complaints and discipline procedures are not discriminatory. In Canada, again, we are seeing a movement towards cultural recognition and reconciliation, although I think there's probably still quite a long way to go, but there's a huge willingness to go there. So, regulators are thinking about this. They are developing new policies. They are examining their internal processes and procedures, but they absolutely need to go on doing it.
Have you seen anything? These sound like a lot of ad hoc, individual, and reactive movements. Have you seen anything sort of formalized in codes or in statement or intent?
Well, again, one of the problems, as I indicated earlier, that is that regulation is often quite local, and because we also have, in many, many jurisdictions, separate colleges or separate regulators for individual occupations, which I've always thought was a bit strange, you finish up with, in some areas, with regulators that have a tiny number of registrants. 500 and something, for instance, if you're the regulator of dietitians in New Zealand. So these fragmented regulatory approaches don't make it easy to have an overarching strategy on anything, I have to say, but certainly not on equity and equality. And if you then, for instance, bring in some of the occupations, for instance, in health, which are not mainstream, and I think of traditional Chinese medicine, which is mainstream in China, of course, but not mainstream necessarily in the West, I think you have real problems about diversity and equality of access. And that extends then to the users of the services. And whether, even having created a diverse profession, you are still effectively excluding some of the users of that profession.
So, I mean, as you mentioned, it's all very fragmented and local. We've talked in the past about unification or nationalization of regulation to a certain extent in the UK and Australia in particular. Do those present opportunities for the formalization of approaches or standards when it comes to diversity?
Yes, they do, and I think that's desirable, but I don't think you need to only, you don't only need to create larger regulators in order to get more consistency. There's no reason why regulators shouldn't have consistency between themselves on a voluntary basis. And I'm kind of surprised when I talk about, well, why can't we have common ethical standards in a profession? I don't see why the ethical standards for lawyers in one province or one state should be different from the ethical standards for lawyers in another. And yet in certain jurisdictions that's true. I can understand why you might have different clinical standards between a dentist and an optician. Of course, they're doing different clinical activities, but their ethical standards should surely be the same. And having a common set of ethical standards is entirely achievable on a voluntary basis. But, you know, regulators generally, professional regulators, not all of them, but in my experience, many of them, are obsessed with we're different, we're special. You can't be anything like us, you know. We're pharmacists. You know, nobody else is like a pharmacist. We're lawyers, we're architects, we're different. And I find that very unhelpful in terms of moving forward to common goals and common services and common standards.
I feel like we could devote an entire discussion to the streamlining and consolidation of ethical standards across locations and professions. And but before we move on from it, I am curious, have you seen any regions or jurisdictions internationally that have come to the same conclusion and said, hey, one region's ethical standards are not so different from another's, let's consolidate and unify? Or is this largely something beyond the scope of regulatory movements?
Well, I think we have a good example in the creation of the Australian Health Practitioners Regulatory Agency, which was created right across Australia and covers a very large number of professions. So there's a very much strong move within Australia, not to uniformity, but to harmony, both between professions and across states and territories. In the UK, of course, regulation is UK-wide, so there is no difficulty, for instance, a doctor trained and working in London suddenly moving overnight and working in Scotland, in Edinburgh, and we also have mutual recognition with Ireland. And there are, strong efforts in Canada to get mutual recognition between the provinces in Canada so that health professionals can move freely. But those are mainly done on occupational lines, and they're not always done across professions or across the national legal framework. I remember, for instance, the engineers in Ontario have some entry rules for people wishing to register as an engineer, that they have to sort of work in Canada in order to be familiar with Canadian geography. Well, that seems to me to be an extraordinary rule, first of all, because Canadian geography is incredibly diverse. So no engineer, unless they waited till they were 60, could possibly have covered all the geographies in Canada. But it seemed to be a rule really there to stop anyone who learned their engineering in a different geography from making it difficult for them to register. So, there are archaic rules that people don't realise usually are creating a barrier which is unnecessary, particularly in a modern world where in that case, most engineers don't do building work at all. They do software engineering or something else entirely.
That's true, where knowledge of geography would be highly impertinent.
Yeah. And I mean, that, you know, sorry to, but that's another great example. I mean, if you look at software engineering, you know, I mean, we're talking, you're in Toronto, I'm in London. The software we're using might have been designed in America, created in Hong Kong. The equipment we're using, certainly the equipment I'm using, was probably made in China. You know, the idea that there's a kind of jurisdictional borderline around regulation is increasingly unrealistic.
Which I suppose is a natural byproduct of globalization, that regulation and licensing has sort of lagged on and has yet to catch up.
Yeah,
when,
I think so.
When we, you know, we all have the classic story of being in Canada or the U.S. and or in the U.K. and being in an Uber or a Lyft or a cab, and the driver is an immigrant who is probably far more qualified than to just drive a cab, might even literally be a rocket scientist, and can't find the work. Is this in some ways an extension of the whole diversity in regulation question? Is this one of the products or extensions of it?
I'm not sure I want to blame regulation for that in particular, because many of the what you'd call underemployment of immigrants is not necessarily in regulated professions. It's just generally in the difficulty that immigrants experience in getting into appropriate employment in a new country. And I mean, it's an absolutely real problem, and where regulation plays a role, it's got a duty to do something about it. But we can't say regulation is solely responsible for that underemployment. And you know, it may relate to cultural issues, it may relate to language issues, it may relate to discrimination. So I think it's more complex, and I don't think we should try and attribute one aspect of social control to that entirely.
Right, right. What are some specific tactical, strategic things governments and regulators could do to sort of better incorporate diversity into their mandates?
I think governments could be more specific in their requirements on regulators to uphold, as it were, equity and diversity of access. And I think regulators, as some of them are doing, can take a lead in reviewing both their registration procedures and their disciplinary procedures and their standards in order to ensure that they're not discriminatory. And then I think in terms of equity and diversity, which I would say many regulators are doing, they should seek both equity and diversity within the profession. But they shouldn't think that's the end of it. We need also to have equity and diversity in terms of access to the profession. And that will mean opening up our minds to alternative ways of providing service. I think there are two proper charges for regulators. One is your profession diverse and properly reflective of the community that you serve? And is that diverse profession providing service that is properly reflective of the community you serve?
And I suppose in addition to statutory commitments, there's also this nebulous idea of moral duty, right? And how that's incorporated into it all. It's hard to draw clear lines around that, but what would you say on that note?
Well, I'd say I don't think that moral duty is nebulous. I think moral duty is pretty clear and pretty firm. And actually, I think it's people who have a proper moral compass who have led the structural changes within regulators, because regulators are people too. Regulators, as people working in regulators, are driven by the same or a set of moral values themselves. Where I think there's an issue with, and I wouldn't just include regulatory or licensing bodies here, but where there's an issue is the tendency to hide behind your legislation and to say we can't do things that are not specified in our legislation. Whereas my approach would be to say we can do anything that isn't forbidden by our legislation, as long as we are in line with the objectives that we've been set within the law. So I think there are many people in regulation who are morally committed to these changes, and those individuals will find ways of bringing about change and progress. And we shouldn't just rely on people to tell us to do the right thing. We should just do the right thing.
Right. On the other side of change and progress, where are you seeing barriers? Where are you seeing a push for status quo, maintenance of status quo, I should say?
Well, that's an interesting question too, Paul, because again, it's one of the kind of cultural issues that regulators have, that they are about the status quo. Their job is to set standards and maintain standards. The very activity of setting a standard and maintaining it is about creating a status quo, creating a baseline on which things should operate. And once you've created those standards, it's quite difficult to change them, not least because people have been trained to follow them, you've issued guidance on following them. You can't keep telling people every week that you've changed the standard and they should do something different. So I would say that it's in the DNA of regulation to be stable. And of course, this is why the challenges, for instance, of the pandemic have been significant, because we have had to become agile, flexible, different in our approach in the face of the challenge of coronavirus and the pandemic. And that is actually quite difficult for regulators. And many regulators, again, have done a great job in opening up the regulatory rules to, for instance, enable retired professionals to return to work in the health system, to change the rules for examinations because they can't be done in an examination hall and have to be done online. What will be interesting, I think, is to see how many of those changes persist as we slowly return to a, I won't say to the way we did things in the past, because I don't think we will return to that, but to a more normal, historically normal way of operating. For instance, if as regulators we've said it wasn't necessary to have so many months or hours of actual work experience before you became qualified, because you couldn't go into your working environment as a trainee and do it under the pandemic, if we've suspended that and then we find that actually it hasn't caused massive harm, are we going to reimpose those rules? Or shouldn't we say, well, we didn't need those rules in the first place? And I think there may be a challenge to some forms of over-regulation in our systems that perhaps we may find we can do differently and still maintain our commitment to safety and public protection.
I suppose the same could be said of examinations as well. I've noted that a number of regulators in the U.S. and in Canada, to varying degrees, made it okay to do their examinations remotely. If that's acceptable now, is there a case for moving back to the standard approach to examinations pre-pandemic?
Well, my question there would be, which is the most efficient and most effective? So if there's no evidence that examinations online are somehow easier to cheat in or of a lower standard, then why doesn't that become an option in the future? I have just in the last year, during lockdown, completed a postgraduate degree at London University, and we did our examinations online, and it was as scary an experience for me as doing all my other examinations in an examination hall. But I think the marking system took into account some of the differences that we would have had. And I think I have no sense that those examinations were not as rigorous or as effective. I think the problem lies much more, or has lain much more, with the inability, as I said, to do practical work. So, if you're training as an engineer or a radiographer, you actually need to do the job in order to learn the job. And I think that will be a difficult thing to abandon, and has been a problem when we've been working online. But, I think what this proves to us is that we can achieve the same ends in different ways, and that maybe we'll have greater flexibility in how we do that in future.
Right. Do you anticipate that there will be a strong move to restore things to the way things were? I mean, it sounds to me like a lot of these regulatory bodies and functions have interest in the status quo, for better or for worse, in general. Do you think there's going to be strong moves to remove these modifications, such as for examinations, that in a post-pandemic world?
Again, I don't think it's possible to generalize about it, because of the fragmentation of the regulatory model. And I think different regulators will approach this in different ways. But I think overall, most regulators are being thoughtful about it, and they're thinking about what they should retain in terms of the changes and what they should reverse in terms of the changes. And I hope they'll do that on the basis of genuine risk assessments of whether any of the changes have actually increased risk or whether they have been managed successfully. And I think professions themselves may challenge their regulators if they see regulators reverting to ways of regulating that they find unnecessary, having proved that we can do things differently. I mean, obviously, you know, regulation is a public good, but over-regulation is a public harm. So we really need to be sure that we don't go back to any form of over-regulation if we had it and have shown that it wasn't necessary.
On diversity, just jumping back there for a moment, I want to talk about some of the, because I think it's an extension of cultural differences, some of the cultural differences that we might see in regulation around the world. I mean, similar as the requirements for, you know, entry to a profession may be into far removed regions, there can be considerable cultural differences in terms of what is viewed as permissible. For example, what might be viewed as not permissible conduct in Canada, in the U.S., something that would get you, you know, barred from ever practicing again, might be permissible in other areas that have a different cultural makeup and a different cultural history. Can you speak to that at all, where you've seen those differences play out?
I think those differences are very real, actually. And they're, again, in a sense, not about regulation as such. They're about the cultural values within a particular society, which regulation to some extent will reflect. And, you know, it's a good question. People sometimes say to me, so, you know, what on earth would get you struck off round here? Because the answer in some jurisdictions is virtually nothing. You know, I know legal regulators who tolerate dishonesty. I would have thought dishonesty was fundamental to being a lawyer. You know, a dishonest lawyer cannot surely be a lawyer, but in many jurisdictions, you know, dishonesty is allowed, and maybe a sanction of a few months suspension is considered appropriate. So dishonesty is treated quite differently in different jurisdictions. Sexual misconduct is treated quite differently in different jurisdictions. I think perhaps the biggest argument is the extent to which your private life as a professional is relevant to your professional life. So in some approaches, lack of, we talked about moral purpose, but lack of moral behaviour in your private life is considered irrelevant to your behaviour in your professional life. I remember a case in the UK, actually, of a dentist who committed a significant number of frauds relating to a housing business that he ran, you know, building and buying flats, apartments. And he was, you know, prosecuted under the law. He was sentenced. And people said at the time, Well, he's served his time for his fraud, and there's no evidence that he's a bad dentist. And a more extreme example is one which was highlighted at the International Medical Regulators conference in Melbourne a few years ago, which was the question, you know, if a doctor who murdered his wife and he went to prison and he served 10 years in prison. And when he came out of prison, the question, he applied to go back on the medical register. And the question put to the conference was, in which jurisdictions would that be considered possible, let alone appropriate? And of course, in many developed countries, the answer was outrageous. If you've taken a human life, you can't possibly be a doctor. You can't possibly be someone who's committed to doing no harm under the Hippocratic Oath. And yet, in the African country in which he worked, he was restored to the regulator, to the profession. And when I asked someone about it afterwards, they said, well, you don't understand. You know, we have, you know, murderers are 2 a penny here, but doctors are in very short supply. So it seems to me that there is, you know, that there is, if you like, a cultural shift in values that we also need to take notice of when we think about how regulation works. So I am mindful of the cultural context in which regulation takes place, which might, of course, contradict my argument that we need less local regulation. But we do need regulation that is aware of local circumstances. And we've seen that. We see that in war, don't we? We see that in the amazing people who go and work for you know, aid agencies, where we often do not apply the same regulatory framework to them that we would in their own country. But to go back to that distinction between the regulated and the moral, we do intend and expect people to keep fast to their moral compass.
Just for a moment on that doctors in short supply quote, is that, or maybe I'll ask it, in Melbourne, was that received as compelling enough a reason for permitting that sort of practice to, or that individual to practice in spite of their considerable history?
Well, I don't think I can make a generalization about that. I think there was some incredulity and there was also some understanding of the circumstances. But it's interesting, at the same conference, I remember another much less dramatic example, which was, supposing you're a health professional of any occupation, and you have convictions for drink driving. Now, the evidence is that if you have one conviction for drink driving, all that means is that you've been caught. It doesn't mean, it's most unlikely to mean, that it's the first time you ever did it. So we then have to ask ourselves whether people who are prepared to take that risk, not only with their own life, but with other people's, are people who are showing a cavalier attitude to the well-being of others, and therefore are they people whose private lives affect their public, their professional life? Now, in the UK, for instance, if you have a conviction for drink driving, it is within the powers of a regulator to have you medically assessed to ensure that you don't have an alcohol problem. And if you do, there might be some form of remediation required. In other countries, that's ridiculous thought. In fact, someone at that Australian conference, an Australian, but I couldn't possibly say who, said, "Oh, I don't know what this fuss is about. Surely everyone drink drives." Right. Now, that again caused both laughter and surprise in a big conference, but was obviously a reflection of a particular cultural position. So, again, this goes to that question you asked me earlier, which is quite a complicated area. How does your private life intrude or not intrude on your professional responsibilities? And it comes down to the requirement in many, many professions to be of good character. But how on earth do you define good character? I mean, I think you can define it, but again, good character is a cultural construct, which gets us back to all the issues of equity and diversity.
So it sounds like, if I'm hearing this correctly, you know, there's no generalization here, and in some jurisdictions, you will find that professional personal lives, there's a wall in between the two, and in some there's a window, and in others a door in terms of how far the regulator will go in looking at your the history of your personal life. Correct?
Yes, ish. I think there's a generalization of questions and issues and problems, but I don't think there's a generalization of solutions. And although I think I would be surprised to say that there's ever a complete wall between private and professional life. In other words, you can do what you like in your private life, but I think there are different levels of acceptability. I mean, another example, isn't it, within our current experience is health professionals who are anti-vaxxers, and there are some. And to what extent should a health professional who has a personal private view of concern and resistance to either vaccination or to these vaccinations in particular, can they possibly express that in any public way at all? Are they even, you know, censored for holding those views? So, you know, I think that's quite problematic, and I know that the attitude of regulators has been different. So the general, the Nursing Council in the UK has struck off a nurse for actively promoting anti-vaccine views, and doing so in public, and doing so in a very strident way, and doing so saying, "I am a nurse and I'm speaking as a nurse when I tell you not to get vaccinated." So she was disciplined and she was struck off. And she was considered to have absolutely crossed the boundary between having a private opinion that she kept to herself and making that opinion public to the potential detriment of many people. But I know in other jurisdictions they have really struggled with that. They don't feel they can take disciplinary action against health professionals who put stuff on Twitter or Facebook and so on. So it's a new, partly because these new technologies have sort of pushed people's private lives into the public domain. So I think these challenges are going to get greater for regulators.
On the hypothetical doctor who may be an anti-vaxxer, I don't know if it's a fitting or appropriate analog, but What if we look to, for example, a criminal defense prosecutor who may be, an advocate for social justice, rights, change in their personal lives, but, go in their professional career to defend some of who might objectively be called, some of the most heinous and prosecuted criminals that we deal with today. I mean, can we take what's involved in their personal life and compare it to what they do in their professional life, if it's, even if it's incongruous?
Well, I think that the ethics within the law are actually quite clear on this, because first of all, you have an overriding ethical duty to provide access to justice for everybody. And so any barrister who is, or solicitor who is defending someone accused of a crime may indeed think that crime is heinous, may indeed even think the person they're defending has done it, but they would still take the principled stance that that person is entitled to the best defence that they can provide for them. And in some jurisdictions, certainly like the UK, the so-called cab rank system means that, if you're a barrister, you take on the next case that comes along. You can't pick and choose. Otherwise, people would always be picking the easy cases. However, of course, the accused person has choice as well, or at least if you're a rich accused person, you certainly have choice. So I think probably the law handles that issue fairly well. But there are, lawyers specialise. There are lawyers who work in human rights and public policy practices. There are lawyers who work in criminal practices. There are lawyers who work in, property sales and purchases, and so on. So some of that will be about personal choice, and some of that will also be about moral views. I don't think that's so different. I don't think that people's personal morality interferes with their professional duty in that regard. Certainly not in the law.
We've touched on sexual misconduct and the varying extents and extremities of it a couple of times in this. In this chat, and this might be a much bigger conversation that we'll have to follow up on, but I just want to sort of get your read on, since 2017, I'd say more or less, we've seen a unfolding, I guess, as it were, of the realities of sexual misconduct in many licensed and unlicensed industries. Certainly Hollywood comes to mind. I'm wondering if that has played out in the world of professional licensing. If for lack of a better term, we had seen a pervasive burying of the truth over the years that is starting to be more acknowledged or come to light in a bigger way. Is this something, in terms of sexual misconduct and allegations thereof in the last few years, is this something we're seeing more of a pattern of coming to light in the public sphere?
Yes. I would say I've seen a huge change in 15 years toward of the attitude of disciplinary panels towards sexual misconduct. I would say that 15 years ago, in many of the regulators that I was aware of, sexual misconduct was not treated with the seriousness that it deserved. It was considered inappropriate, but there was the same challenge that we've had in the law courts as well about, well, it's he said, she said. We are going to not give particular weight to the witness. We are going to give weight to the denials by the registrant. And I've seen even when people were found to have breached sexual, made inappropriate sexual advances, that they've received really very minor sanctions. For instance, you know, you've got to work with a chaperone in the room. Well, and worse, in my view, these decisions being kept secret. And so, I mean, I would always ask myself, so if you have a teenage daughter and you're sending her off to see a doctor, don't you have a right to know whether that male doctor has a proven complaint against them in relation to inappropriate touching? And regardless of whether they are deemed fit to work with a chaperone, which I think personally is nonsense, shouldn't you know that? Because how can you know that they have to work with a chaperone if you haven't been told? And shouldn't you have the choice of not going anywhere near that doctor at all? So I find the combination of lenient disciplinary decisions and secrecy really one of the most abhorrent things about the way regulation has worked. And I do think regulators are starting to put their house in order on this, but only really many of them because of public pressure. And fortunately, that public pressure is getting stronger. The media is challenging decisions, and in some jurisdictions, I think of Alberta, for instance, legislation has been introduced to make it mandatory to deal with any allegation of sexual misconduct in a different way from other allegations, and to ensure that those are public.
Thanks everyone for listening to our chat with Harry. If you'd like to learn more about what he's thinking about other matters in regulation, I strongly encourage you to check out Ascend Magazine, where he contributes a regular, exclusive column. More recently, he wrote about whether good governance requires good character in the first place. We also have a great story about how his report set the stage for regulatory reform in BC. And we also have a deep dive into right touch regulation. You can find the links to those pieces and more in the show description, or head right on over to ascend.thentia.com yourself. If you'd like to receive weekly regulatory news roundups, I strongly encourage you sign up for our Week in Brief series, where we cover all of the top stories in regulation and digital government. And also subscribe to our podcast for more interviews with regulatory leaders from around the world. Next up, for example, I'll be chatting with Marie Bismarck. She is a public health physician and health lawyer, well known across Australia and around the world. She leads the Law and Public Health Group at the University of Melbourne. And we talk all about her experience dealing with the pandemic as a not only just a healthcare leader, but a champion of healthcare rights across Australia and indeed around the world. If you're a regulatory expert and would like to participate in a podcast or contribute an original article, please reach out to me. You can find my contact info in the show notes. And as always, thank you for listening.